Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schrockerbrod, again, and as always, with my friend and colleague, Dr. Joe Palmer. How you doing today, Joe?
Doing well, Gene. How are you?
Not too bad. So Joe and I really are excited about this show today because we're going to do our version of Myth Busters, or debunking some myths. Obviously, it's not going to be as much fun as the TV show because we don't get to blow anything up, unfortunately. At least not today, right, Joe?
Not today, Gene. And you won't get to see our lovely faces either. So,
not yet. At some point.
Another drawback.
So what we're going to go through are some very typical and common misconceptions in the field of rehab, physical therapy, and we'll hit into fitness a little bit. Things that our patients are miseducated about and that Joe and I typically have spent a good bit of time educating them on. And as always, we'd love to hear some of these or different ones that you guys encounter. So let us know either at the iTunes comments, Therapy Insiders Pod, or send us an email at therapyinsiders@gmail.com. So the first one that we're going to go into are diagnostic imaging. You want to start out with that one? Some of the things you hear about, Joe?
Oh, well, everybody loves the test. And in today's medical society, it's normal for a patient that I see to come in with 2-3 sets of x-rays and maybe 1 or 2 MRIs, maybe more tests. And what the patient, I think, is looking at is they're looking for a reason for their pain. They are, they want a test to validate why they are having the symptoms that they're having. And they want to see, well, yes, that's the area that's hurt. I'm not really making this up. I have something that I can hold on to. And I think from a physical therapy standpoint, this can be part of the battle. This can, you have to, get through to them and try to educate them on what things you can change, and you're not likely going to change the results of any of their testing. But the bottom line is that those things that show up on MRIs and x-rays don't necessarily have to cause their pain. And I think that the sooner that you can break that dependency on that test with your patients, the more they buy into your program and the better result that they eventually can achieve. What kind of tests do you see, Gene?
So yeah, the biggie is the question I always get, should I get XXX, right? Should I get an MRI? Should I get an x-ray? Should I get this? Should I get that? And my response to that is always, what do you expect after you get the result? Meaning that if the MRI shows you have a really bad disc herniation, which obviously you should pick up with clinical skills and subjective exam and all that, is are you ready for what that entails? Now, a lot of them will answer yes, but a lot of them don't even think about that. It's such a gut reflexive reaction at this point. Should I get a test? And most people don't even know why they're getting it, aside from they want to know, like you said, what they have. And more times than not, they will have this MRI and it will have, let's say, a little disc herniation at L4. But all their symptoms are from S1, S2. So they're like, oh, yeah, I have a disc herniation. I'm like, all right, yeah, great. But that has nothing to do with your clinical presentation. So that's the big, big educational piece. And a lot of patients don't know that even after an initial injury, let's say you twisted your ankle, they go to urgent care and they get an x-ray and it comes back negative for fractures. But what people don't know, and I hope that most of the clinicians that are applying these is they at least let the patients know that because of the swelling, you can cover up an x-ray for a week or two. So it's nice to at least get a baseline maybe, but you need to come back and get another one done in a couple of weeks. So there's a lot of misconceptions on MRIs and x-rays. So we mentioned, let's say a patient comes into your clinic and says, yeah, I had an MRI and it showed that I have a disc herniation. But not all disc herniations are painful, are they? What do you tell your patient after that? How do you explain to them? How do you break that myth that just because you have a disc herniation doesn't mean that that's where your pain's coming from?
Right. And I simply explain to them that an MRI is a snapshot in time and it's in a static position. Most of the time, laying flat on the table. Or in that dreaded tube that your patients will talk about.
Yeah, gotta love the tube.
And what I'm telling them is that's not a functional position. That's not how you live your life. And what we need to do is find which positions make your pain better, which positions make your pain worse. We need to work functionally towards goals of movement. I explained to them that if I took 100 patients and put them in an MRI machine, 80 of them may show similar bulges or disc degeneration, and they may have no symptoms at all. So what I hope to dissociate is the static picture of the MRI from the painful stimulus. There's a want to put those together. The patient wants the picture to equal the pain, and so it takes some time. But going back to the point that you made, I also tell them, I say that MRI is good, but if you're not ready to take the next step, which may be a surgical option.
Or an injection.
Or an injection. Then what we're going to do is the most beneficial approach at the time. Let's try to strengthen, stretch, and find positions of comfort that we can let the disc and the inflammation dissipate in normal fashion. So,
and that's the big thing is the inflammation. So I always explain to my patients, listen, you might have pain. You might have pain right at that area, but your disc, the herniation, the bulge is nowhere near pushing on the nerve fibers, which generally is the painful stimuli. Disc herniations in themselves, they are not highly innervated structures. So you can have a herniation with maybe minor discomfort, but what that will lead to is that inflammatory response, and that inflammation will push again against the nerve endings and will elicit pain in certain motions. That's why injections a lot of times are performed and they feel a lot better because that injection gets that inflammation out of the area. But the big thing is that I always explain to them are the compensations that they make. Once the body feels any kind of pain from inflammation or whatnot, it will instantly adapt. And you can attest to this, Joe, because you see this thousands of times, is once these compensations happen, it snowballs. So what I tell them is, listen, this is what a typical presentation of a disc herniation is. If you have a real serious disc herniation, you are in severe, severe pain. Most of your trunk motions, flexion, extension, side bending, rotations are going to be limited, and you're going to be in a non-obligate limited position. You can't control it. You're just going to be, your functional capacity is going to be decreased. Now, if you have a patient that comes in, they can flex, 90%, they can extend 90%, they just have little limitations mm-hmm. here and there. That's when I clear up their compensations and instantly they feel a lot better. And again, this is with a good objective exams. You're doing all your radicular testing. You're not assuming anything just because you've seen a lot of these. But you do your test and you see, yeah, it's the compensations at this point that are really problematic for you. And sure, you still have your disc herniation. This is, again, one of the myths is disc herniations go away. They shrink, they do things like that. No, once you have your disc herniation, it is what it is. But you can reduce stress on that area by fixing the facet joints and figuring out what compensations occurred at that point. So going into our next myth, going along the lines of MRIs and X-rays and diagnoses, is the dreaded, and I repeat, the dreaded arthritis. So it's a death sentence, apparently, Joe.
King Arthur. Yeah. Hear a lot about people coming in and saying the Arthur's got them, and you know, the fact of the matter is that people live with arthritis, and it's not painful. People can compensate and continue to move and function. When it doesn't come until the joint degenerates to a point where the bones, then you get in a bone on bone like crepitus, that you're really looking at a serious situation. So I try to tell my patients that movement is a good thing. Gentle movement is what lubricates your joints. It's what brings and moves the fluid and brings nutrition to those articular surfaces that are degenerating. And so that's the simple answer that I give my patients when they ask, you know, what they can do. I want to try to get them into gentle movement. What do you tell your patients?
Well, first I want to know whether they actually have a severe level of degenerative arthritis, or they had an MRI or most likely an X-ray done, and their physician, or they just read the report themselves and saw the word arthritis. They didn't see the mild before it, or they chose to ignore the mild before it. But I start out with statistics. I tell them, listen, all of us build arthritis around 16, right? Gravity wears us down, wear and tear. We all have arthritis. I kind of give it a little spiel about difference between OA and RA. And I tell them, listen, just because you have arthritis and very similar to the disc herniations does not mean that that is why you're having pain. The arthritis is not necessarily causing the pain because you're not at that stage of arthritic pain. And this is when you have to know your clinical signs of arthritic pain. And it's when somebody has arthritic pain, you are in pretty severe pain. Not a lot of motions feel good. I think most people instantly picture knees and ankles, but you know, we have arthritic conditions in the spine. When people have them, generally in older age, you know, you have your stenosis, lateral central stenosis. Those present in different ways. But again, when people come in and say, my back hurts, I have arthritis, that's when we kind of break it down what arthritis is, because I think it's, people can think that you can just say, yeah, sure, you have arthritis, and still do your treatment and they'll feel better afterwards. But I think people, our patients, should actually know what the medical term is, what the clinical presentation is. Will it help overall healing? No, probably not. You know, they'll still respond to your techniques just the same way, whether they think they have arthritis or what arthritis is. But I think it helps overall moving forward that they kind of have a grasp of these terms. And I think it helps them buy into the treatments as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gene, here's another thing that I get asked sometimes. I don't know whether you do as well. Everybody wants to know how they can get that washboard stomach, how they can give me some exercises that can make my stomach look good. How can I get rid of this, you know? And I often have to tell him that there's a lot more that goes into that. So what do you tell your patients?
The dabble into the fitness abs. Patients always ask me this in a little bit of a sneaky way because they try to justify it in a stability type of I'm doing this to feel better for my back. And then after a little conversation, they're like, it always comes down to, I shouldn't say always, but more times than not, it comes down to, I want to have a flatter belly. What are some exercises, like you said, that I can work my abs that will also make my back feel better? So some people genuinely think that having stronger abdominals, and the most common abdominal they're referring to is the rectus abdominis, of course, your six pack, that washboard type of stomach. And my first question to them after that is, why? Why are you trying to work your abs? And then follow
because I want to look good in a bathing suit, Gene.
Well, of course you do. Well, and I'm not gonna comment on your two piece, Joe. But I always ask them, what is the function of that muscle? And most patients obviously don't know the answer to that because they don't study anatomy. And I tell them quite bluntly, it's to keep your organs inside your body.
And make me look good in a bathing suit.
Again, your polka dot two piece is not going to get discussed, Joe. So I tell them, if it fails, you get a hernia and it pops out. But that muscle is not a eccentric concentric muscle. It's not designed to do crunches on the ground. It's designed to do, if anything, isometric exercises. So my follow up after we kind of have this piece on what you're really trying to accomplish and what the muscle really does is isometric exercise. And you get a, you know, you can do the staples, the planks, the side planks. But there's plenty of other exercises you can do to really isometrically work the abdominals, again, the rectus mainly. And then I kind of try to push them towards, if you're really going to work abdominals, hit your internal external obliques, which have some more functional motions. Research has shown that actually offers that kind of general stability versus more that intrinsic stability from your transversus. And you know, I tried to show them a few things that I know will work, will help with some lumbar stability, but also incorporate some of their abdominals so they at least get a feeling like they're working their six pack abs. But I don't know about you, Joe. That question always follows up with, so will this make my fat cells muscles? Will this turn my fat into muscle? Will it, Joe? Will doing some crunches make your fat turn to muscle, make you look better in that bathing suit?
Well, it hasn't made me look any better yet.
Keep trying, buddy. Keep trying.
The simple answer to that is no, Gene. What I tell my patients is that if you're really looking to see those muscles, then it starts in the kitchen, and it's about what you eat. Not as much about what you're doing. I think you're exactly right, and the exercises that you listed are great stability exercises, but that's not going to get them what they want. And the fact of the matter is that there is no changing fat cells into muscle cells. You can lose fat deposits. And you can rediscover what muscle looks like,
or at least decrease some fat deposits. I don't know if you'll ever lose them, right? They kind of hang around, but
they decrease in size. Right. You're correct. Yes.
Do patients accept that, or do they just follow up with, so what exercises can I do? Great. Thanks for bursting that bubble for me. But what exercises can I do?
Yeah, well, I think the bottom line is that they've been doing those exercises for years. So when you start talking to them about the fact that, yeah, it's not really going to help you see results, then they can look back on their experience and they come around to that. But you know, nobody wants to make the dietary changes that are necessary. So in the end, they continue to do their crunches or try to do their exercises. But I think that most of the patients that I see, you know, are searching for that pot of gold.
Yep. And that's that big myth. You know, if you're doing crunches or even if you're doing isometrics, like we talk about, that you're going to show the abdominals, and that's not the case. It's like you mentioned, it's several factors that play into it. It's nutrition, it's overall burning calories. I mean, it's weight loss with resistance training to build the muscles. So you can do crunches, sure. Will that muscle get stronger? Absolutely, even though it's not designed for that. You'll have a great, great six-pack of abs on top of that keg that you have on you. So if you don't lose it, you're never going to see it. So it takes a dedicated approach, and it's not easy by any means. We all know, you know, you can have all the information in the world laid out in front of you with a roadmap telling you exactly how to do it, but you still have to do it.
Right, and you said resistance training, and why is resistance training so important, especially with the push towards more aerobic activity, burning calories? Why is that resistance training so important, Gene?
Right, so you can burn all the calories you want, but if you don't have a underneath structural support from the muscles, and muscles work through resistance training, you get that hypertrophy in the muscle fibers and the muscle cells, and that's how you build up the muscles. But not only that, unless you're doing, you know, single joint bicep exercises or tricep exercises just to get, you know, specificity in the muscle, if you're doing combined motions, it's functional for you. You know, there's plenty of research out there that shows when you build up resistance, when you do resistance training and build up those muscles in themselves burn a ton of calories. I guess we can classify that as a myth that resistance training puts on bulk. But that's not true. You will get more muscle, which can weigh a tiny bit more than fat. So the scale might say one thing, but the muscles will help out functionally. The muscles will burn calories.
I think that's the important point that you're making there, Gene, is that the muscles themselves, they need to survive. And in order for them to survive, they've got to burn calories. And that's where you're getting your benefit from your resistance training.
Yeah, and it's important topics to cover, because nowadays, as physical therapists, we're wearing a lot of hats. You know, for some people, we're pseudo-primary because we are open access states, a lot of us, and they come see us before anybody else. And a lot of patients, you know, we see a lot of athletes, and we kind of wear that hat of personal trainer, physical therapist, and doctor. So, you know, nothing is above us. You can't say, oh, yeah, you know, fitness questions are above me, because you're not going to do your patient service. I know when I work out at the gym, I almost have to be like a horse with blinders on. I mean, I can't look around some of the stuff that I see. You know, and I don't want to be that guy walking around telling everybody at the gym, hey, do this, you might hurt yourself.
Don't be that guy.
I'm really trying not to, but once in a while I see somebody and I know they're going to jack themselves up, and I, you know, walk over and give friendly advice and say, listen, you're going to jack yourself up, here's why. And most of them are very receptive to it. But, you know, you're helping your patient as well, even though you might not be reaping the benefits.
So let's talk about stretching, Gene. Let's talk about some of the myths and your point of view as far as when to stretch, why to stretch, does it even work?
Whew, that's a Pandora's box there, Joe. Stretching in the most common type of thought of stretching, the static stretch, is in many times useless. It's been proven to be useless in terms of injury prevention. To really stretch muscle, you essentially have to hold the same static position for prolonged period, 15, 20 minutes, to initiate creep in the tissue and to create stretch. What generally is thought of as stretch is that, you know, a couple minutes holding the static stretch, and you have a relaxation in the muscle, and you have the perception of stretch, and you have the perception of feeling better. But as soon as you start walking around and you try it again, it goes back to the same way or the way it was. My biggest problem with stretching is when athletes, runners, or I guess I could classify runners as athletes too. I can get a lot of flack for that one. When they stretch before running, and they tell me they're warming up, which is the complete opposite, because stretch is a cool down in every sense of it. So when you're stretching before doing an activity, you're going backwards, and you can actually cause injury. So to me, there's very few times where you're doing static stretching. One, if you have a contracture, if you have post-surgical, if you need to, you know, stretch through scars, or if you have capsular issues, but then you're more stretching the capsule when you're doing prolonged stretching. Now, if you really have those limitations, I'm all for doing a static stretch, but know what you're going to accomplish. You know, you have to leave that muscle or that joint exactly as is for 15, 20 or so minutes, several days a week for several weeks to get some stretch into it. So for you know, 90% of the people, I'm very much against stretch and or stretching. And a lot of times if you feel tight or, you know, you have limitations, find out why you're tight. If you've been tight all your life, that's just how you are. And you can start, you know, you can do yoga, you can do things like that, and you might get a little bit more motion. But chances are that's more facilitation in the tissue and not so much actually stretching or initiating increased length in the muscles. What about you?
So how do you explain let's go with a yoga program that over the course of time increases flexibility in, let's just take it, flexibility in its simplest terms, meaning range of motion through or about the joint. So let's say, you know, let's get specific. Let's talk about knee flexibility, hamstring stretching. You know, over time, and consistent performance of a yoga program, how do you account for the change in range that a participant may experience?
That's a great question, and I get asked that a lot because, again, yoga is associated directly with stretching. But I think yoga goes beyond that. I think you're working functional poses that initiate a lot of stabilizing muscles, and I think you are working the joints. So I think a lot of stretching or a lot of tightness is facilitation from the aberrant input from the nerves. So I think what you're doing with yoga, similar with Pilates, is you're creating an environment of stability into these joints, and I think they get to relax, and I think you have decreased aberrant input. So I think you have decreased facilitation as in turn of increased flexibility or increased stretching. So you will get more flexibility, but just because your nerve isn't saying constantly, you know, fire, fire, fire to whatever muscles that it's going to, whatever level that is involved. So I think once you have a little bit more stability in the system, which yoga, Pilates, all those programs give you, because, you know, with yoga, you're not just sitting around, you know, stretching a hamstring. You're doing very tough poses that require not only stretching of the muscles, you require a lot of work, a lot of activation of those muscles.
Absolutely. I believe that there is a role for stretching with muscle tightness. I believe that for pre-athletic activity, you need to do a dynamic warm-up, not a static stretch.
So you consider dynamic warm-ups as part of this group of overall stretching?
I do.
So that's a big differentiation point, because I don't consider dynamic warm-up as a stretch. I consider that as a warm-up. I consider that as an athletic activity, as exercise, as part of that versus stretching. I think that's a big differentiation point to bring out, because a lot of people don't consider that stretching. You know, when you say stretching, you're talking about sitting and getting muscles to lengthen.
But, right. And I do, I do give patients static stretches. So I've seen patients improve range of motion with static stretching. Now, we are also doing a lot of other joint work and mobilization and stretching to the capsules. So there are other variables involved, but I think that the bottom line, when you put a patient on a stretching program and they perform it over a course of, you know, 6-8 weeks, and continue to perform that, they will, even if it is only a relaxation of a muscle, and we're not talking about myofibrogenesis, you know, creation of new sarcomeres. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about adapting to a demand. We're talking about a state of increased flexibility. I can look at a patient and take measurements on an initial evaluation. I can introduce stretches and other treatments and come back at the reevaluation time, and they can improve in their range of motion. And that's taking that range prior to stretching them that day. So for that day, their range of motion is better. And I don't really care whether it's a relaxation or a lengthening of the muscle. If that joint has an improved range, that's a benefit to me.
And that's a fair point. But my question will be then is, why is the muscle tight? Right? That's my big pet peeve with stretching. And, you know, at least you cover, you go through the joints and you do other things. But a lot of clinicians won't do that. You know, I've heard plenty of stories from patients that have been to other places and they get stretches, they get some exercises, and, you know, they get useless modalities. That's why I think you always have to ask that question, is why are the muscles tight or perceived as tight, especially when you have a unilateral tightness. And, you know, most people will see that. You'll do your hamstring extensibility, you'll test whatever you're testing, and you'll see increased tightness on one side or the other. And that, you know, that's tone, that's not tightness. And then you ask yourself, why? What can cause increased tightness in muscles? And there's not a lot of things in our musculoskeletal world, aside from acute trauma or infectious diseases or some kind of other kind of processes or pathologies going on that's affecting the muscle directly. You know, we're going right back to the spine, we're going right back to the nerves, and we're going through the usual list of suspects. We're going through segmental facilitation, we're going through disc herniation, we're going through spondylosis or spondylolisthesis or any one of those conditions, and we're going into stenotic conditions, and we're going through all the usual suspects of what can cause it. So, you know, that's my one big thing is, yeah, you can stretch and they might get better and they might feel a little bit better, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think there's a quicker way, a more efficient way than giving them stretches. Now, once in a while, I'll do a stretch in the terms of or in the form of hold, relax, because, you know, sometimes you need to get that direct decrease in tone before even getting to the joint, and it does feel better for a lot of patients, and it gives you that ability to treat whatever the underlying cause is. But in terms of just stretching, very rarely do I give a stretching program to my patients.
Well, I'd like to hear what everybody thinks about that. I'd like to have people comment, send us emails. We will post some articles that we've found as far as some literature reviews on some stretching. Does it help? Does it hurt? Let us know what you think. Let us know what you do in the clinic. That's part of what this is all about. We want to hear from you.
Yeah, let us know some of the myths you guys hear about. I know there's plenty of myths and even pet peeves that that we deal with on a daily basis, let us know. Comment section, Therapy Insiders Pod. Please leave some comments on the iTunes under podcasts. Check us out. We are under New and Newsworthy on the front page under Medical. So thanks a lot for listening and getting us there. And we'll be back again next week. We'll cover some more topics, and we hope to hear back from you guys. And let us know what you want to hear and talk about.
That's right. Give us some comments. Let us know we're not wasting our Sunday afternoon. All right, here we go.
So you were talking about PT and the standard of care as far as being able to take the information and use the evidence that, and experience that, that you have to promote a treatment plan. Do you feel the PTs shy away from things like manual therapy because of the litigious society that we live in?
No, actually, I don't think that is a major issue. I think what anybody will do after a period of training is get comfortable in what they've been trained at. And if manual therapy hasn't been part of it, they're going to be reluctant to go and do that because they're unfamiliar with it. I think there's got to be an introduction to the effectiveness of a particular thing, whether it's manual therapy or whatever it is. And if you haven't had that introduction, you're not going to be interested in it. So I don't think anybody's overly concerned with the litigious aspect of manual therapy. PTs just don't get sued. If you look at the number of PTs and the number of lawsuits, I mean, these numbers are silly. And generally speaking, when there is a complaint or a lawsuit, it's all about billing. Eventually, it comes down to what you're billing. And then it's usually dropped anyway. So no, I don't think this is it. I don't think they're scared of it as such. I think it's a matter of familiarity or unfamiliarity. And it's tough to break conditioning. And 3 years in any school, any educational process, is about conditioning.
There's a lot of continuing education out there for various models. There's not a lot of all-inclusive things, meaning it's either manipulation or it's exercises or it's PNF. What do you think about a model that follows, you do your manipulation if it's warranted, then here are the exercises or the retraining you should do to follow that?
Well, I think our program does that. I wouldn't have any argument when somebody says, you may do that, but you emphasize the manual technique part. I think that's probably extremely true.
And then what is your program?
It's IMPACT. Institute of Manual Physiotherapy and Clinical Training, IMPACT. And it's, I don't think it's emphasized. I think you're absolutely right. I think we could do a lot better job on the exercise part of this. At the same time, we're going to have to find space to do that, which either means extending the program out or cutting back on the other stuff. Basically, we do teach it. We've got videos of it, and we're weak in it. I think you're absolutely right. You get somebody like IPA, which is very, very strong in exercise, and not terribly strong, or not as strong as a program that that concentrates on the manual techniques. You've got the reverse with us.
Let me ask you this: there's if you're doing exercise, but there is that biomechanical component that hasn't been fixed, and vice versa, if you're doing that biomechanical component but the exercise hasn't been added, is it still beneficial to the patient?
Yeah. I think it's changing a little bit, but if you look at the chiropractic practice of old, there was no exercise given. If you looked at the old physiotherapists, and I include myself in that, there was exercise given, but it was half-assed, and nobody really meant it. You got very good results, and the results could last 3, 4, 6 months before you had to see the patient again. One of the big issues with giving an exercise program is expecting the patient to comply with it, and this is my biggest bugbear. A really good example of this is McKenzie. You have a patient, and you can get some stunning results just by doing passive extension exercises, the half push-ups. Not on everybody by any means, but on the appropriate patient, you give them 10 patients, they stand up, the pain's halved, they're moving better, give them another 10 and they're almost pain-free. I mean, sometimes this is absolutely stunning. So whatever it is, though, you treat them and they get better, and you say, McKenzie now, I don't know what the new group might be doing or whatever. But Mackenzie would say, okay, look, I need you now to do 10 half push-ups a day at the end of the day to reverse the effects of the flexion activities and posture you've been doing. Now, whether or not this is valid or not, it's a whole different issue, but that's what they told the patient. That's what I've told patients. And say, okay, fine, it's only 10 a day. That's all I want from you. And they come back in a few months later and send me back. So, and you say, are you doing the exercise? No, I'll stop doing them. And these people would not even do 10 half push-ups a day. Now what we're expecting to do with core stability therapy is not 10 exercises a day. We should be asking them to do these exercises every hour, and there's probably three or four different exercises. They need to be doing as many as they can safely control. So we're expecting a very intrusive exercise program on these people where they're exercising every hour or even three times a day, which I don't think is enough. And we're expecting them to do multiple repetitions of each exercise, and they won't do 10 half push-ups. So I'm not sure where the expectation is, how you can expect them to comply with this when they wouldn't expect them to comply with the other one. I think athletes might do, and I think the truly desperate who are recurring every week will do. But I've got a feeling that the guys in the middle, the average guys, are not going to do this. Doesn't mean to say you shouldn't try, but it's a lot of effort.
So pain inhibition, pain in general, is a very big deterrent, especially when doing exercise. And one of the main reasons I asked you the previous question is, if you have a biomechanical limitation that's painful, can you really justify doing exercises that are not compensatory without fixing that initial biomechanical problem first?
Okay, so I'm assuming you're not doing the exercise for pain modulation. You're doing this for a rehab issue?
Right, but even if you are trying for pain modulation, a lot of times, how successful is it really?
No, I think movement and pain are perfectly reasonable things to put together. I mean, most people with severe pain will feel better if they're laying in bed and getting up and moving around. Movement modulates pain. I haven't got a problem with that at all. If you're talking about doing rehab, though, to have a definitive neurophysiological effect, and if the exercise is causing pain, then I think it's counterproductive. I think you've got to get rid of their pain before you start giving that type of exercise. And the same, even if the joint's not painful but causing reflex inhibition, so the muscle's weak, you're not going to be able to get that muscle working until you get rid of the reflex inhibition. Now, you can do that temporarily easily enough just by putting proprioception in. But over the long term, you've got to clear up that that joint dysfunction so that the muscle can contract reasonably properly.
So you said proprioception into the muscle, into the joint. There's various ways, and again, goes back to our conversation earlier, whether it's manipulation or mobilization. What would you feel in the joint? You said manipulation is that jammed path of mechanical and feel a little springy but doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it is to me, yep.
What if it's just, let's say, stiff? What if it's, how do you differentiate between a jam joint versus a stiff joint versus a capsular restriction in
well,
the joint?
Well, I would equate capsule and stiff the okay. same way. Actually, you used exactly the words I'd say. One feels jammed and the other one feels stiff. That's it. Again, you can argue about the validity of that, but I mean, for me, that's it. One feels stiff. It's got a little bit of give to it, but it feels stiff. The other one just doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. It sort of bounces back at you.
So there's another big technique out there is muscle energy mm-hmm. technique, right? Michigan State's very big on it. What, in your opinion, is actually happening when they're doing a muscle energy technique, and can it fix a joint subluxation?
Okay, well, I've been using muscle energy since 1977. It's a trouble getting old, I forget names. Styles. Ed Styles came up and taught this in Vancouver. So I've been doing this for a long while. I tend not to use it as much now. It was partially effective. It's like everything else. Everything works at some point or another for something or another. What it's doing, well, actually, it depends on how you're doing it. Muscle energy, this is interesting, it was actually called muscle energy transfers. that sort of got changed to muscle energy techniques, and now it's just muscle energy. Muscle energy transfers was you made the muscle contract to transfer the energy of the contraction into the bone and move the bone. So it was a way of mobilizing a joint, repeated contraction and mobilizing the joint that way. That was the transfers. Muscle energy techniques can still be the same thing, but a lot of this now is about relaxing the muscle and then moving the joint passively, not manipulating it, but allowing it to move passively. I think if you're looking at jam joints, if you have a jam joint that isn't very stably jammed, then actually using a muscle to move the joint, you may be able to do that. If the joint is more jammed, then I don't think that's going to happen whatsoever. So as far as relaxing muscle is concerned, fine. I mean, nothing wrong with relaxing muscle. But some or another, you're going to have to shift the joint. And it may be that the relaxed muscle allows the patient to shift the joint when they start moving.
So still a lot of PTs get fairly successful and positive results with muscle energy. And I know a lot of people say they use it on patients they don't feel comfortable manipulating, whether it's geriatric or if patient or if PTs just don't feel comfortable manipulating in general. Is it safe to say that when they're using that muscle energy technique and you see really significant results, that the joint's actually not jammed, but there's that other end field that is perceived as jammed, whether it's stiff or something else, and what you're essentially doing is mobilizing the joint capsule a little bit, creating a little stretch in there?
No, again, I don't believe that. No, I don't for a moment believe that. If the joint capsule is shortened because it's got scarring in it, adhesions in it, or whatever, you are not going to get that out with a little stretch like that. And in fact, it looks like you need like a very prolonged stretch to take adhesions out of a capsule or a ligament or scars out of this stuff. Very prolonged stretch, low intensity prolonged stretch. We don't do that. This is why you resort to serial sprints and dynamic sprints. I don't think we do a good job at stretching capsule and ligaments at all. I think when you're talking about good results, first off, you have to ask, what do you mean by a good result? If you're looking at an immediate response and you're basing this on, for example, position tests in the spine, and the position improves and is symmetrical and the patient feels better, yeah, sure, you can get that. The question is, if you have them jump up and down a few times, does the position last? And what are they like a couple of days later? And that your result isn't about what happens immediately. Well, it is, but that's not the definitive result, what happens immediately afterwards, for you to assess how good that technique's worked. You will assess it next time they come in. Has it improved over time? Can you do more than you could do? Is it less painful and so on? So when we say good results for this, you've got to define what you mean by a good result. I haven't got a problem. I think it's interesting, but almost everybody who successfully does manipulation, regardless of wherever else they go and what other techniques they learn, will end up doing manipulation, whether or not they incorporate the other stuff or not. But it ends up with the manipulation being the basic, the base technique. If you can do it, and you can do it well. So regardless of everything else that's going on, they seem to go back to that.
So while we're talking about capsular restrictions and needing that long, prolonged stretch to really affect change, how long would you say something like that takes to do as far as getting the capsular flexibility back? And how long have they been restricted in your experience? I've seen patients come in, a lot of times they're not acute. A lot of times they have dysfunctions that have gone on for a period of months. And over that time, they've developed capsular restrictions on top of that initial segmental dysfunction. How do you go about working your treatment for those patients?
Okay, my experience has been that the presence of capsular problems in these segmental dysfunctions is rare. Almost everything is manipulable, almost everything. So I really don't see this. I think you'll get I don't believe in adaptive shortening, for one thing. I don't believe that because a joint doesn't run through its full range of motion on a regular enough basis, that these structures, muscles, tendons, ligaments, will shorten. I think for a ligament or a muscle or a tendon to be inextensible, there has to be an injury to it. There has to be fibrosis, adhesions, forming the rest of it. So I don't accept adaptive shortening. I can disprove it over and over again with people. So I won't accept that. So for me, you have to have a reason for having a capsular tightness in that part of the spine, and that's either an injury, systemic arthropathy. Osteoarthrosis will do that. But this tends to be a region-wide problem rather than a mechanical segmental dysfunction. I certainly wouldn't argue against the possibility of spondylolysis, restricted movement, but this is a general stiffness rather than a segmental one. So I don't honestly see that many unisegmental, unilateral capsular restrictions. So it's never really been an issue for me.
But what we do see is a lot of soft tissue restrictions, hypertonicities, tenderness to palpation. And a lot of people spend a lot of time working through the tissue and say that you're working through scar tissue and mobilizing scar tissue. And that's not really the case, is it?
I don't know. I mean, I'd want somebody to tell me when it was scarred. I mean, if you're going to scar healthy tissue, you know it when it happens. And it's going to hurt, and there's going to be a major incident. And I want somebody to tell me when that happened, if they say they're doing scar work on this stuff. I think most of this stuff is referred. I think you have referred tendons. You have trigger points, which are really coming from the spine. There's nothing really there in most cases, unless it's degenerated and dead. I don't think I've massaged anybody since I was in Norway, and I did that there because I had to, because it was expected. But I don't think I've massaged anybody since then, to be honest with you.
I'm sure your wife doesn't appreciate that very much.
Yes, she does. You haven't seen me massage. No, I think in almost every case, you go in there and manipulate what it is, and all of a sudden this stuff disappears.
Well, what if you get to the point where there's too much soft tissue guarding to manipulate, then what do you do?
Well, guarding is a matter of either the volitional guarding by the patient, usually because of anxiety or spasm. In either case, you can't manipulate them.
Is there anything you can do to reduce spasm or hypertonicity to be able to?
Well, spasm and hypertonicity are two different animals. Hypertonicity, in my experience, is due to nociception. You just get an increased basis.
So what would you do for that?
Deal with whatever's causing the prolonged nociception.
Well, let's say it's a segment you want to manipulate it, but you can't because of that prolonged nociception.
You can temporarily decrease hypertonicity.
How would you do that?
You put in proprioception. So basically, you can do some modes before you manipulate.
Any other modalities? I know people use ultrasound a lot, even though most research has disproved ultrasound.
Well, you see, good research is research I agree with. All right, it's like, how do you measure intelligence? Intelligence is based on how much they agree with me, the direct relationship. And I agree with, like, when it's good research, it agrees with me. I've thought mostly ultrasound in PT was a complete waste of time, and I've thought this basically at school. It may have an effect, but usually the way it's used is not effective. I mean, putting it on pulse and then rubbing it, the dosage you're giving this patient is silly anyway. It may have an effect if you put it on undulsed and hold it there and lower the dose. If they start to feel stuff, it may have an effect then, but the way we use it is ineffective. So given that, I don't know why we're still using it. I don't know why the insurance companies are still paying for it. And I don't know why it's still being used and taught in schools.
What about the other popular one, electrical stimulation?
I love muscle stim. Now, we're talking about muscle stim.
NMES.
Yeah, I love muscle stim. I think it's got an awful lot of uses. It's a great pain modulator. I think it's better in TENS. So you can use it for pain modulation. This way now you don't get the same waveform you get from TENS, but you get the input from the muscles now as well as the joints moving and so on. So I think more than makes up for that. Venous congestion, it certainly will make a muscle contract that's inhibited, because he's got no real choice in the matter.
What about parameters, if we can get a little bit more specific, if somebody that's listening wants to really use the NMES, if they want to start manipulating and they find this guarding and it just can't get a good setup, and they, like you said, want to use that component, what do they use? Are we talking biphasic, Russian?
I'm not sure I'd use it for guarding.
For hypertonicity, let's say.
Hypertonicity? Well, I wouldn't use it for that. It's so easy to decrease that type of hypertonicity. It takes a few seconds using your hands. I'm not sure I'd use it for that anyway.
So what would you use it for?
Actually, I like it for isolated contractions. Tennis elbow. I mean, basically, you get the thing to contract and then pull the wrist down against a contraction. You're actually giving that tendon a really quite a good stretch. Again, it's got to be a tendinosis rather than tendinitis. Use it for pain. Use it for not re-education, but I don't think it works terribly well for re-education. But it will make the muscle contract and make it active when you get behind it. Feet. I think it's a standby for every foot problem I've ever come across. Get the intrinsic working with that, and you've got to mobilize the foot. It makes it a lot easier to do these exercises or to teach these exercises after it's done. If I could only have one machine, it would be a muscle stim unit.
On the foot, are you talking plantar surface,
yeah.
Dorsal surface?
Yeah.
What about in the spine? I know it's mainly used a lot of times in the spine now. What is actually happening when you put it on the spine?
What do you mean? I mean, basically make the muscle contract.
So right, so let's say lumbar spine, what muscle do you really want?
Well, I can't pick out. I mean, there's no way using a surface electrode you can say this is hitting multivitus.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing I can say, if I'm getting a strong contraction of the erectors, then I'm almost certainly the multivitus contracting, providing it's capable of doing that. That is, it still exists. You can palpate directly by the side of the spine. You may be able to feel the multivitus lift up under you. So you will, I think, if you get this up strongly enough, you will get multivitus. If you really want to do it, and I know people who do this, you stick a needle in the multivitus and then put the machine on the multivitus so you absolutely know what's happening.
In terms of EMG needle?
No, dry needling.
And you see the needle come up?
Yeah. Oh, you can see this in the arm. It's ridiculous when you do see it. I mean, it's a great pain reliever for acute backs. It will wake the muscle up. And so now if you want to start some re-education stuff, I'm not a great lover of core stability exercises, but you know, if that's what you want to do, then give them 10 minutes of that before you actually start. You're getting all that proprioception going, and it'll reduce the reflex inhibition. So it's got bundles of uses.
So you mentioned transversus abdominis and just core retraining. You said you're not a fan. And that's one of the big, big
mm-hmm.
topics that's studied and written about all the time.
Yeah.
How useful is it? How functional is it, again, that we talked about? Because it's not a contract, relax muscle, correct? In terms of volitionally.
Well, I think that isn't my biggest problem. It isn't a volitional muscle, and I think neither is a multivitus. I mean, these are anticipatory muscles, and I think trying to make them contract volitionally is a little bit purposeless, to be honest with you. But the reason I don't like core stabilization, apart from how difficult it can be, is the idea that I'm going to splint the spine and then work around the spine. For me, why not just put a back support on them? What I'd rather do is dynamic functional re-education. I'm using the word functional, but dynamic re-education of stability. For me, that's PNF again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do trunk PNF, neck PNF, shoulder PNF. You've got to recruit the muscles first, and that's easy enough to do. And you do that reflexively by putting more proprioception in, but then dynamically retrain the spine. And, you know, I suppose there is any research for it, but it doesn't mean to say it doesn't work. It just means to say nobody's researched it. So I don't like core stability therapy, and I think the other problem with it is, again, you've got compliance problems. With all this, all of it's got compliance problems. The nice thing about reflex recruitment of these muscles and PNF is you don't have to put as much effort into it. A patient is going to give it up when they leave the clinic anyway. So it's not quite the waste of time. And the exercises are a lot simpler to do. So I just don't like core stability. I just don't see it as being a particularly functional exercise. And as I say, I'd rather just put a belt on them for particular activities that give them trouble.
Jim, let's talk for a second about dry needling and your opinion on the validity and effectiveness, especially in the context of today, PTs being able to do it and the contention of acupuncturists. Did you talk about some of the differences?
You got the wrong person. I used to do acupuncture in the 70s and 80s in BC, and I don't do it anymore. As far as dry needling is concerned, I've really never done it. I know a lot of people who do use it, who I've got a great deal of respect for, and basically their opinion is that it's a great adjunct to everything else, and it's particularly in patients that you can't do manual work on. For the standard patient, I doubt very much there's anything needling can do that I can't do with my hands. And I think that applies to all the people who are doing dry needling who are sensible about it and do it well. But there are patients where you're going to use it and where you can't use your hands, so it's got effects there. As far as it, the acupuncture, I don't know. Acupuncture baffles me, and that's not to say it's not doesn't work. I believe it does work, but it baffles me on how it works. And it's not. I realize that there's all sort of neurophysiological theories on this. I'm not sure that they're accurate. I mean, the Chinese have been using this for thousands of years. I've seen on TV, whether it's true or not, but I've seen it on TV, where they're actually using acupuncture needles as an anesthetic during surgery to replace general anesthesia. So I'm not sure that the neurophysiological modeling of this is really as covers all of the facts as we know. So I don't know. It's a short answer.
I think the big different or the big issue is that people confuse the two quite often because they're the same needles. You know, like you said, dry acupuncture is Eastern medicine. You have to know energy, meridian points. And Western approach, dry needling, is a lot simpler. You know, we're a much simpler folk, right? We find a trigger point, we put a needle into it, and whatever physiologic response happens to it. But it's just like any other tool that we add, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's manipulation, mobilization, e-stim, or dry needling.
It should be. I've seen, though, very good manual therapists, especially in the programs we're running, who have got so far with manual therapy and then found needling, and everything gets needled. Everything gets needled. Often to the point where they don't manipulate anymore. And I've had experience with that where I've come along, they're needling this and needling that, and the patient's feeling a bit better. And you basically turn around and say, you know, this isn't moving. And you hit it, and all of a sudden the patient's is asymptomatic. It's like what's sexy now displaces what worked then. And that's not the way to do things. You get rid of stuff when it doesn't work for you, and you include stuff when it does. And you don't get rid of stuff that's working simply because this is new.
Well, I think that's a pretty good way to finish out. Somebody that's old saying, I don't want to be replaced, essentially. Well,
I do want to be replaced.
Well, we appreciate you chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim, for bringing sexy back.
Thank you.